This is the happiness quotient. Welcome. Before we get started, consider checking out A Course in Happiness. In this short, colorful guide, this easy-to-follow roadmap provides gentle, positive suggestions that for eons have been taught by the masters on how to stop chasing happiness in our path toward unlocking the mysteries to life's big questions. It offers some guideposts to contemplate and put to use in your daily life. Go to patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, where you'll find a free PDF download of A Course in Happiness.
All of my wisdom came from all the toughest days. I never learned a thing being happy. All of my suffering came, I didn't appreciate it. I never learned a thing being happy. I'm about to know how.
I'm Tom Pollard. When I first met today's guest, we were both embarking on our first ever Mount Everest adventure. The year was 1999. I was 37 years old, hired as a high-altitude cameraman for PBS Nova and the BBC on a co-production documentary to try and change the history of Everest once and for all. We were, of course, looking for the remains of George Mallory and Sandy Irvin, who had disappeared 75 years previously, last seen climbing for the top at over 28,000 feet, or 8,500 meters.
I got a happiness journey.
If we could find that they had, in fact, made it to the summit, it would change the history books forever, supplanting the first recognized ascent by Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay 29 years later in 1953. Jake Norton, my guest today, was 25, like myself, a Massachusetts native. He first climbed Mount Rainier with his dad at age 12, and by 18, he was guiding for Rainier Mountaineering and soon was leading international climbs around the world. Although we were living in two different worlds, I with a son and a house, he as a guide with a camera, we were natural friends, seeing eye to eye on topics of the day, spirituality, politics, having been brought together by a reverence for all things Everest. To date, Jake has been on 8 Everest expeditions, summiting 3 times, with the rare distinction of having made the top from the north and the south. Last I saw him was 2019. We were both on separate expeditions on Mount Everest in Tibet with the same quest to find the body of Sandy Irvin, George Mallory's partner. It was an odd situation to be in, one of my best friends from the mountains on a different team. And because of our affiliations with two competing networks, me with National Geographic and Jake with Discovery, we had to keep the specifics of our efforts secret from each other, although between you and me, everyone knew what the gig was with the other team. This interview is a rare look into the greatest mystery in all of adventure. Did Mallory and Irvin make it to the summit of Mount Everest in 1924? Jake himself has been on 5 search expeditions for Mallory and Irvin. 4 of them were official search expeditions. And personally, Jake has more boots on the ground experience than any human being alive or otherwise in the search for clues to the mystery of their disappearance. In 1999, Jake found the first clue during our historic expedition, an oxygen bottle from the 1975 Chinese expedition during which Wang Hongbao found Mallory's remains. On that same day, after about an hour and 45 minutes of searching, Conrad Anker hopped on the radio calling a mandatory team meeting. In a 2012 interview with Outside Online, Jake said about the discovery, Conrad, quote, was about 50 meters away from me, frantically waving his ice axe above his head. I walked over and happened by proximity to get there first, and there was Conrad standing silently above the remains of a fallen hero, exactly as he appears in my photo from the cover of Outside. It was the most humbling experience of my climbing career and one that will stay with me forever." Unquote. Here it is, my April 12th, 2021 interview with climber, filmmaker, photographer, public speaker, United Nations ambassador, husband and father of two, owner of Mountain World Productions, my friend Jake Norton, from his office in Evergreen, Colorado. We started our conversation with me first bringing up the topic of the shape of mountains today and how things have changed since we first met in 1999.
Jake, how are our mountains now? What are the environment is changing. You know, I, 10, 11 years ago, I did a film, you know, with Conrad for PBS on the melting glaciers of the world. And,
yeah.
And it says like the Gangotri Glacier, which feeds the Ganges River, of which you did a documentary, that glacier will melt in 50 years completely. And that was 10 years ago. And that feeds, in essence, a billion people who are threatened of having that river become a seasonal river. That's shocking.
Yeah, it's so terrifying. I mean, as you know, I mean, we look around the world, any of these, especially the great ranges, I mean, all ranges, but you know, you think of the Himalaya, they're so massive and impenetrable and you know, seem eternal. And then you go into them and yeah, and we see these glaciers. I mean, you and I, since we've been traveling to those areas 20 plus years, I mean, you can see the change with the naked eye, the way the Khumbu Glacier, you know, has receded and pulled back and things are changing. I mean, the state of our glaciers, of our mountains, of these changing climates is really, really frightening. And I always talk about how, you know, I think to a lot of the world, mountains seem like this distant place that doesn't affect me. I'm, you know, I live in Illinois. What do I care about the mountains? I live in Arkansas. I live in the Indo-Gangetic Plains. The mountains are, but you know, there's the old adage, shit flows downhill and water does too. And everything, you know, the mountains are the bellwether of our climate and we're seeing that change. And it's terrifying.
So tell me a little bit about your blog and your website. You have a newsletter that you send out. I'm as a guy who produces a podcast and is challenged to take the time out of what hours there are in a week. And my kids are out of the house, by the way. So I've got that excuse. Just to get one episode a week is a gargantuan effort sometimes. And you're cranking out some blog posts like on multiple times a week. I think I've been trying it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm trying to, and that was certainly the intent. You know, I've always loved writing and sharing, and as, you know, I think like you, as much as the mountains come to define us as individuals, they don't really. They're a part of a much greater definition than one chapter of our books. And so, yeah, I was like, gosh, I want to write about mountains, but I also want to write about other experiences and different things. So I decided, okay, I'm going to take the plunge and start this blog that I just call the Undefined blog, where I, you know, kind of have free rein to dive into the things that at least I find interesting and are pulling on my cerebellum a little bit. And it's been a lot of fun, but to your point about, you know, finding the time the last few weeks, I've been immersed in this panorama project, which I'm hoping to finish this week, but also just, you know, life has gotten in the way. And so I've fallen off the wagon whatever.
The wagon unhitched, right.
Yeah. The wagon left me behind. So I'm trying to get re-engaged to keep producing some more content and get my head back in the game.
So the inevitable. We can't have any conversation ever without, well, we already talked about Mount Everest once, so I guess no meeting between us would not lead to at least two conversations about Mount Everest. I would venture to say that you very possibly have more boots on the ground experience searching for Mallory and Irvin or remains of their existence up there in those expeditions of the 1920s than anybody alive. I'd say maybe Jamie McGinnis has at least some firsthand knowledge because he's been through there so many times.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to ask you if you think that's true. There could be nobody who knows more about what is up there in that death zone, up in the yellow band area of Mallory and Irvin. This has really been a thread in your career and your life.
Yeah, I mean, it has. You know, it all started with us together up there, gosh, 22 years ago now, which is insane.
Yep.
But yeah, you know, it was interesting. Discovery wanted to play it off as this obsession, which perhaps that's the right word. I never felt like I, but maybe.
Cynic's yeah. book. Second word. Nice. Mystery, obsession. Yeah.
I haven't hit the third word yet, the death part.
yeah. We hope that one comes naturally at the age of 105.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I guess through some lenses, it certainly could be an obsession. I mean, to me, I think like you, you know, I always knew the story of Mallory and Irvin going into 99 and was certainly enthralled by it. But that expedition being up there, finding relics on the mountain and, you know, Mallory's remains aside, just finding evidence of them and being in their footsteps opened it up in such a new way. And I think also made me realize that there was so much depth to those early expeditions that I think is lacking in a large way today. And there's so much we as modern climbers can and should learn from those early teams. And not that they did everything perfectly by any means. They made a lot of screw ups and a lot of misjudgments, but we can still learn so much, and so much of it is being lost and, you know, swept away in the winds of history. And so, yeah, for me, I just wanted to tell more, have and continue to want to tell more of the story of Mallory and Irvin, but also all the pre-World War II expeditions, because what they did was just beyond words. I mean, I'm always telling my kids, like, you know, they've been to Nepal a couple times, and it's like, imagine, you know, Mallory and Irvin, you know, and Norton and Somerville and Beetham and all those guys, you know, they got on a boat in February and sailed to India, took trains across, and then walked 5 weeks just to get to the mountain they hoped to climb. And yeah. I mean, it's such a different world, and through no man's land that no foreigners had really seen before. And I mean, it's wild.
So yeah, that's a whole subject right there, that the idea of having an authentic exploration and expedition. There's fewer and fewer of those these days, and that is a whole new topic. And I'm going to do a quick side note to Wade Davis's most recent book called Magdalena. It's about the river in Colombia, and it will blow your mind. Instead of having these little expeditions kind of just be points in to kind of, if you will, charge our need for thrill and excitement, it's more about involving yourself in a culture and a meaning and a history of something. And I guess in some respect, your relationship with Everest is so much more than that. So you were there in 99, you went back in 01, weren't you back there in 04? Was that the north side? So there's three.
Yeah, and then 03 as well. On the north side, but that wasn't a search expedition per se, although I did a bit of poking around, but I was filming on that one. And then and then back again to the north side in 2019 when we were there on dueling friendly expeditions.
Yeah, you know, not a lot of people know about the dueling expeditions. And I guess you would, because you'd see that Discovery has a film and National Geographic has a film about our not united attempts to go and discover the body of Sandy Irvin up there. And it's interesting because here we are, two networks that are at fierce odds with each other. And there's two expeditions sharing the mountain, occasionally crossing paths, of a lot of very, very, very good friends. Like when we got together, it was like a party, like long lost buddies. And there was no doubt that, you know, we were more concerned about our friendship than one-upping each other. And that was so amazing. And now I know in 2019, you guys spent a lot of time on that one particular day. I can't remember what day it was. I think it was before Summit Day, the 22nd or 21st. And you were up in searching. You covered a lot of ground up there.
Yeah. I think that, you know, as you know, and for the listeners, you know, we had so much has changed since you and I were there in 99, where, you know, we could kind of go and cowboy and do, you know, the Chinese government were not telling us what we could and couldn't do. I mean, we were there before anyone else and doing our thing. And now you're on a very short leash. They tell you when you can arrive at base camp, and it can change at the drop of a hat, and when you can go up the mountain, and then there's a lot more people. And so both our teams, we got compressed into these really bad search scenarios and windows. And so we opted, in hindsight, I probably would have changed it. I think you guys made a really good play on the traffic and everything, but we ended up getting those 4 search days, 3.5 out of camp 6. But you know, playing around all the people that were up there, kicking rocks down, trying not to kick rocks on them. As you know, it's wild and hairy terrain. And what we were really focused on, definitely wanted to get out to where you guys ended up getting to, but never could because of traffic above us. And I was really focused on this area called the Warts that are to climbers left of the exit cracks as you get out, because it seemed at the time that that's where 2 theoretical old sightings of a body, one by a guy named Zhu Jing in 1960 and then by Sherpa Chiring Dorje in 1995, where their paths might have coincided, and turned out to not be accurate, or if there was something there, it's long gone. But actually, Jochen Hemleb's team had been there in 2010, or was it?
Yeah, and then in 12 also, I think. Didn't
yeah,
they? Yeah,
yeah, I think so. And they had a bit more snow, so we were hopeful that, oh gosh, maybe on the dry year that we had this past, or in 2019, we'd find something. But we finally got out. It was Sid Pattison and I, and then Ken Saul's cameraman coming out as well. And you know, once we got through the Warts finally and on to that northeast ridge crest, the thinking had been that, gosh, maybe Irvin, you know, after the accident, Mallory falls, we find him in 99, Irvin survived. This was my thinking, at least. And maybe he wandered out along the ridge crest trying to find the route back down in the dark, scared, and eventually got out to that area and tried to wait out the night and didn't make it. And as soon as Sid and I poked out into there, I looked out at the terrain. I was like, there's no way you'd mistake this ridge crest for what you walked up 12 hours before, because it's just gnarly up there. So we knew pretty quickly that it wasn't worth searching further along that ridge crest towards the pinnacles.
So you, on that, in 2019, you did find a mitten, was it? Or was it a sock? So you found
No, that was, I found in what year was it? 2001, found a mitten just kind of slightly to climbers right of the Warts, climbers left of the exit cracks. And that we're pretty sure was probably a 24 mitten, so had to have been Mallory Irvin's, given where it was. there's, you know, some misinformation out there that it was just lying there on the ground. It was actually under a rock. It wasn't, you know, didn't seem to have been something that blew there. It looked, at least somebody at some point in the intervening years had put a rock on it. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting clue. Then in 2019, Sid and I, we went out the Longland Traverse from the 1933 high camp quite a ways down and hoping to find something there. And I thought I found something, but it ended up being a tatter from the 1933 camp and a little bit of tent fabric up there.
Amazing. So if you were to, having been up there so many times and really knowing the lay of the land, there are some people who believe that Mallory's chosen route was not up and over the second step, but kind of skirting around underneath it up to the main couloir that heads up to the summit pyramid. Do you think that would have been possible? And do you believe what do you think? But do you think it's possible to go underneath it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so, the history is so hard to decipher. And I, you know, obviously we know that Norton and Somerville 4 days before had gone underneath. They took a lower traverse line. We know that, you know, Wager and Wynne Harris and Shipton, went the high route in 33. Wynne Harris and Wager actually went up to the first step and then traversed under, trying to figure out a way to shortcut the second step. And they made it about to Norton's high point in the couloir. And, you know, I've always thought, and probably perhaps erroneously, that Mallory was more intent, based on Norton's experience hitting soft, kind of sketchy snow in the couloir, that he was going to go the ridge route. But there is that new information, the note that Mallory sent to John Knoll, the cameraman, that indicates maybe he was going for the couloir. But then somehow they had to have gotten back to the first step, because we found that oxygen bottle there in 99, and we found the mitten there in 01. So there's signs of them having been up there. And so, yeah, it's all just so hard to decipher and figure out, okay, where did they really go and why? And you know, sadly, I don't know how you feel about it, but there's a part of me that wonders if, you know, perhaps now we'll never know. We may not know. There may not be any more telling evidence to find. I still hope that there will be, that something will come out eventually, but who knows?
Did you ever, I've heard, and I'm not sure if you want to talk about it, but did you ever go back to the site of where Mallory's body is or was and look for him?
No, I never did. And there's been part of me that's always wanted to, and all the trips I've been on subsequently, just there hasn't been time to go down there, I guess, cause to or whatever. So yeah, I haven't. But I know you were back, that was 2 weeks, give or take, on May 17th, right? 99. And did you guys go back in 19?
Well, that was part of the plan that Mark and I had, that he was going to unclip and go to the Tom Holzell's slash, if you will,
right,
and look for Sandy. And then he was going to zigzag down, or if I don't even know if you can do that there. And I was going to go down the ropes real quick and unclip and go straight over to where Mallory was. And obviously I had that, which I don't, whether it was a TIA or not, I don't know, but obviously I turned around and didn't go. So I never had that opportunity, but we had extensive drone photographs and video, but primarily the photographs, which you could blow up, just the incredible detail of these photographs. And I looked for, days. We literally spent days going over these photographs. And, we found one body who was the Japanese climber, who's not that far off the ropes. Which you walked by. Well, I know you didn't do the summit in 2019, but so I never had the chance to go, but I had heard that somebody went and looked for him before and was unsuccessful.
Okay, so, looked for Mallory. Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was because of a lot of snow. Now here's, so let's just say, you know, when I went back with Andy on May 16th in 1999, you know, there was still parts of his clothing that was still really firmly frozen into the ground that we loosened up so I could get under to look in his pockets for the camera and everything.
Yeah.
And then we did what we could to cover him with rocks afterwards as best we could. But there was still parts of his foot was exposed and regrettably. And I always wonder if maybe he wasn't so firmly locked down, if it would have been possible for an avalanche then to possibly sweep him.
Yeah. Away. Yeah. Yeah. I've wondered that as well. Like if, yeah, cause we loosened him. We changed things and I don't know that he would have, without any body heat, residual body heat, been able to become readhered to the mountain as you know, and would he have been swept away in, you know, after some disruption, regrettable disruption from 99. So
And then there's also the, you know, the many reports that, you know, before the Olympics were in China, how supposedly the Chinese, you know, they did a sweep of the mountain and tried to remove as many bodies as they could from there. Maybe they went and removed something. You know, and here we are 2 years in a row again. The mountain is not open this year in China. So
yeah,
very interesting. I don't know. It's will anybody? Well, let's put it this way. Do you think, given all your experience up there, the over years and different days of those expeditions, is there anything left to find in that, let's just call it the yellow band area, or should people start looking elsewhere? Like, is that ground covered?
Yeah, I mean, you know, had you asked me 2 years ago, I would have said certainly there's more to be found. But now I kind of wonder if there is in the yellow band. I mean, I still think, you know, Holzell's area where you guys searched, I think there's a high probability Irvin could have been in there, probably isn't anymore. So maybe there's something left behind to give some evidence. But I also wonder, because I walked through most of that area in 04, we had a lot of snow, but didn't see anything. I could have easily missed something. Then you guys were there. but yeah, a big part of me feels like a real comprehensive search in two places above the second step, looking for not any definitive clue, but evidence of them having been there would be pretty massive. If they got that high, I think most of us would feel like, yeah, they probably got to the top. Yeah. If they were above the second step. And then, yeah, doing, which would be crazy cool to see and film and be on, but doing that, you know, that high traverse under the second step, either from the base of the first step over or taking Norton and Somerville's more diagonal route up and getting into the Great Couloir and seeing, is there a route that Mallory and Irvin could have taken up there that would have gotten them through? And B, is, you know, is there a bottle left behind there? Is there any sign of them having been there? Although it's hard to imagine anything would have stuck around there for that long, because that's some steep terrain.
Yeah, it is. It's spooky just to look at. And unfortunately, I never, other than with Andy in 1999. Nice brain. I call that altitude brain.
There's a lot of that going on in my head.
I meant to say May 16th in 1999, Andy and I kind of left Camp 6 or the modern day Camp 3 and kind of went up a little bit and then zigged down to see if there was anything, you know, laterally over and above Mallory's body. And it's so funny because I can remember being there and thinking, wow, if I fell, I would definitely die right now. But it didn't faze me. But sometimes I'll think of it now and just like get chills. Like, Jesus,
yeah.
You're on 10 of your 12 points of crampons on rocks scraping just a point of your ice axe down. It's a crazy place to be. It's mad.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I remember, because I guess with the exception of Ken Sauls on our team in 2019, he and I were the only ones who had been there. And I was the only one who had really searched up high before. And, you know, so just telling everyone like, hey, this isn't El Cap. This isn't, you know, technical climbing per se, but when you get off route, you know, you're suddenly on terrain that you realize the magnitude of it, you know, one, and you realize that you really wish you had hobnail boots, because crampons do not work that well on a tile roof. Yeah. For all the listeners, you know, Mallory and Irvin and the pre-World War II teams, they had hobnail boots. So it didn't work in a lot of terrain, but up on the upper north face, it was actually the right footwear. And as Tom said, we're walking along with crampons on, and you're like a cat with its claws extended trying to climb a tiled roof. You're like, and everything there is just steep enough that if you slip and get going, you just can't stop. Mm. Or very unlikely you're going to stop before some major damage is done. And
look at the shape of Mallory's body. I mean,
yeah,
that was gruesome.
Yeah, it really was.
So then the inevitable, do you think, you know, what does your gut tell you about, did they make it? Could they have? What do you want to believe, and what do you really believe, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm admittedly a helpless romantic idealist. And so I'll answer the second question first. I do believe that, I want to believe that they summited. And I always go back to, you know, we have no proof that they did. And likewise, we have no proof that they did not, you know, it's, and in the evidence and in the whether or not they could have, I don't see anything that tells me honestly that they couldn't have. I mean, if they did try the ridge route, if they climbed, attempted the second step, you know, we as modern climbers gets, and this isn't derogatory towards anyone, because I was in this mindset for a long time as well, thinking that, well, they had to have climbed the second step the way we'd climb it today. They had to try and free climb it, but that's not necessarily how they looked at things back then. And you look at how the Chinese got up it in 1960, and they, you know, stood on heads and shoulders, took off boots and gloves, and the lead climber is able to essentially reach kind of enough holds at the top of the second step to mantle and struggle his way up and get up the thing. And I've got on my blog, a great photo of Albert Ellingwood and Carl Blaurock, two old Colorado climbers doing the same thing called a court d'échelle, kind of 10 fingers. Blaurock is standing on Ellingwood's, he's got one foot on his head, pushing his hat to the side, and another foot on his shoulder, and climbing up a chunk of rock about the same size as the second step head wall. And you know, so that wasn't considered unfair means necessarily back in the 20s. So I look at it as, you know, yeah, it would have been desperate. It would have been crazy. Everything they probably did on that day was breaking the rules, but I still don't see any reason to say they couldn't have done it. I don't see it being out of their reach by any means. It would have been desperate, and we know how it ended. But so yeah, long-winded answer. I still do feel that they could have, and I think they probably did, and that's certainly influenced by my helpless romantic aspects.
That's why I love you, buddy, so much. That helpless, hopeless romance of what is capable, what a human being is capable of accomplishing when he or she has put his or her heart and soul into an endeavor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The dog just gets into the picture here.
Nice.
It is amazing what people can accomplish. And for anyone to say there's no way in hell they made it. And I did say that for years. Mark Sinnott, he didn't correct me, but he said, we can't prove they did, but we also can't prove they didn't.
Yeah.
And I always used to base it on how far, if you will, east of the second step Mallory was. But until Irvin is found or his location is found, we don't know how he might have gotten over there.
So, right. Yeah. And I always think too, like you look at, and of course we don't know definitively, but you look at kind of Mallory's mindset going into 24, you know, you'd been there in 21 and 22, he's 37, almost 38, which was upper level for Himalayan climbing those days. He's got three kids. There's a lot of societal and family pressure for him to be able to provide for them and be the upstanding, you know, British citizen that he should be. And he knows that, you know, he can either, two things can happen out of Everest that year. He can summit the mountain and be the first to do it, and everything is golden from there on out, or he can come back home and nothing down about this, but, you know, continue the life he was doing, being a lecturer and teacher and never quite living up to what I think he felt he needed to and wanted to and deserved. And so, long story short, I think sadly, tragically, he was willing to push a hell of a lot further in 24 than maybe he would have been in 22 or 21. And knowing that it was now or never to get, and I've talked to another friend who's done a wonderful screenplay on the story, Jim McEachin, about this idea that Mallory's only real way home was via the summit of Everest, that he didn't, you know, psychologically, mentally didn't really have another path home, you know, that he couldn't. And he even said that, and I forget who he wrote it to, but we're going to stamp to the top this time and with God with us, or sorry, we're going to sail to the top this time and with God with us, or we'll stamp to the top with our teeth in the wind. You know, he was determined and sadly, tragically determined, I think.
Yeah, what people will do when ambition and desire and you know, it's scary. You've been to Everest on many occasions. You summited three times. You've seen a lot of people who didn't make it. A lot of dead people on that mountain, and it's chilling. It always the sight of another body up there always kind of was a reminder. I felt so much reverence for those people reminding me, like, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
It's not worth it.
Yeah. Completely.
It's not worth it.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's this chilling thing to see. And yet I almost find it a welcoming, tragically welcoming thing to, you know, to be reminded of your own mortality up there. Like, hey, you know, whoever that is was, you know, got at least this high, was probably as good a climber as you are, and might not have really made any major mistake, and they're lying here now, and you could be next, and the mountain, pardon my French, really doesn't give a shit if you're another human Karen up there. So so watch your step and don't be stupid, and don't get too obsessed by the summit, because I mean, I guess it's easy to say when you and I have been there before, but, you know, at the end of the day, the summit is a necessary part of the adventure, but it's really a patch of snow covered in pee and some candy wrappers. It's not all that.
A lot of prayer flags.
Yeah. A lot of beautiful prayer flags, but it's like, all right, I don't know that that's worth dying for, or losing a finger for, or whatever.
Is it a clean slate looking forward? You have any other than the Rowenzori Mountain expedition that we're going to do with a film someday soon?
Yeah, that sounds good.
It does. It sounds great to me. anything on the horizon, or are you just kind of putting the vibes out there, letting something appear?
Yeah. Just really trying to, you know, let things materialize and putting it out there, you know, definitely doing a lot of writing and trying to create new things. And, but for me, I think, you know, I never want to say I'll never go back to Everest, because every time I say that, I end up back there, and I do love it. And I'd go back, I think, for more fun storytelling. There's certainly things I'd love to still do there, but I'm feeling more and more, I think these days, and perhaps always have been, more like, I guess, not of his caliber, but of mentality, Eric Shipton, you know, who people criticize, saying, you know, here was a guy who was a climber, but he was more interested in exploring than climbing. I was just rereading about the 35 trip when they came in light and fast, small team, and he diverted them in the Amadrime and Niono Ri massifs for 2 weeks on the way into Everest, because nobody had been there and he wanted to explore, and they might well have missed their possible window to summit the mountain by doing so. But you know, to me, that type of stuff, getting into some of these ranges that people don't bother to go into because there's not an Amas de Blanc or an Everest or an 8,000er sitting around, that really enthralls me to just bum around and check out cool areas. So those are some of the projects I've got on my to-do list to figure out, all right, how do I get into that place where nobody's been into before?
Absolutely, man. Sinnott said something funny in our, when I interviewed him a week or so ago. He said something like, he goes, all these projects, all this stuff is just an excuse to do cool shit that, you know, so he writes this book, The Third Pole, and I better go to the Royal Geographical Society and look at Mallory's booth instead of taking Norton or Pollard's word for it. You know, and, you know, the watch, you know, was in like this glass case. Apparently the watch that I had in my pocket for a while is radioactive.
Really?
Yes. It still glows in the dark.
So that explains a lot, Pollard. Gosh.
Well, if I did have another kid, it would wonder, now we know why there's two heads on that child.
Right. Exactly. Blame it on 99.
So, dude, any other, anything else, like any other cool shit you want to, like, it's always great talking to you. We could probably hit tangents. If we were at a pub drinking beers, it would go till they close the bar, I would imagine. But
yeah, any
cool, you know, on tap locally or.
Yeah, I don't, you know, for me, I think, again, it's just that urge to explore. Like I drive my family nuts because I hate trails, and out here I'm always, you know, hunting out drainages. I'm like, I want to see where this spring that I found last week, where does it go? So I'm always bushwhacking everywhere, but you know, to me, that it's just that sense of adventure that I get, you know, sadly bored on a trail, and I'm like, all right, I want to see what's over that ridge there. What, you know, I saw a bit of rock sticking out, and you know, what is that, a big dome there that nobody's climbed before? Let's go check that out. So that really feeds my soul all the time. And I think, you know, in this crazy COVID era, where you're probably in the same boat, I haven't been to an airport to fly somewhere. And then this is such a, you know, woe is me first world problem, but I'm like, I haven't flown anywhere. I've barely even left my county in over a year now. And yet there's been this beautiful peace that's come out of it to just say, hey, you know, I've got this world that I ignore half the time because I'm off looking forward to the next Himalayan trip or wherever it is. And now I get to really dive in deep and explore. And I did, speaking of cameras, about 6 months ago or so, I was in one of my drainages. It was a warm winter day, and saw this little glint of light on a hillside. I had just found an old logging settlement from probably the early teens or so, and up on this hillside was this glint of light, so catching the sun. So went up and pulled out this beautiful old camera that I think dated back to about 1918. If I did identify, it was all beat to hell, but found a guy in Memphis, Tennessee who could develop the film and sent it off to him. And unfortunately a tree had grown root in it over the years and destroyed the whole thing. And he was bummed as I was, because I was like, what are we going to find? You know, this could be
George Mallory on the summit of Everest.
That's what I know. That was crossing my mind. I was like,
he made it. Oh my God. How did the camera get to Colorado?
I know. How did that happen?
Yeah. Damn.
But stuff like that, you know, I just love that. It's, you know, and, you know, A, it's some adventure, and then B, this humbling reminder that, hey, you weren't the first one to go down here. You know, there was some dude a tweed coat 100 years before you romping around on this same terrain. I think we can all use knocking ourselves off our pedestals at times to remember that, hey, there were a lot of people here before us doing who were smarter, more skilled, tougher. And that's, I always love that.
In addition to his numerous mountaineering accomplishments, Jake is an ambassador for the United Nations, serving on the Mountain Partnership, an organization that helps to ensure that mountain regions and the people and the cultures around them are represented in specific languages as agreements and policies are developed around sustainable development goals. If you want to receive Jake's awesome, undefined blog, go to jakenorton.com. Click on the blog button at the bottom. And if you want to help Jake with his inspiring work, you can support him with a monthly or annual donation and receive a goodie bag, but you can always receive it for free. Just visit. You will be inspired.
All of my wisdom came from all the toughest days. I never learned a thing being happy.
Thank you to the Wood Brothers and their management for the use of their song Happiness Jones for our theme song here on the HQ, and to their publicist, Kevin Calabro, for helping it all happen.
I got a Happiness Jones, my friend. A Happiness Jones.
If you'd like a free downloadable PDF of the Happiness Quotients, A Course in Happiness, visit me at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient. And for more information about me, to inquire about personal coaching or public speaking, in person or virtually, please visit eyesopenproductions.com or write me anytime at tom.dharma.pollard@gmail.com.
Hey, I have a spark of light to get happy.
Remember, that which we most want to find can be discovered in the place where we least want to look. And the deeper and the darker the well, the brighter the light we will discover. Don't curse the dark cloud. The rain inside may very well turn your garden green. I will see you all real soon.
The happy, 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 happiness zone. The happy, 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 happiness zone. Change.
John's my friend. Happiness just